This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Across the country, women earn less than men, but in Indiana, the gap between what women and men earn is even wider than the rest of the nation. Indiana's average gender pay gap is 24%. The national average, by the way, is 18%. And it's a topic that Women for Change, which is a nonpartisan organization that educates, equips, and mobilizes Hoosiers to make some positive change for women, will take up with another virtual event that is coming up tomorrow evening, July 28th at 6:30 p.m. And one of the speakers, one of the panelists for the event coming up is with us here on the program today. She's State Representative Carolyn Jackson, who represents District 1 as a Democrat here in Northwest Indiana. And Representative Jackson, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the invitation.
Well,
I'm very excited to talk about that topic because it's dear to me.
Yeah. You get the opportunity to be on the panel with a couple of very interesting people that are knowledgeable in their own right about the issue of gender pay gap, with people like Chancellor Allison Bell with WGU Indiana, and have a representative from of the faculty of the University of Indianapolis on the panel as well. Will you bring us up to date on first your thoughts about getting together to talk about this topic?
Absolutely. You know, it's a topic that needs to be discussed, and more than anything, changes need to be made, and they need to be made immediately, because so many women are suffering, and as time goes on and on and on, it mounts up of money that women are being shortchanged. You have more and more women who are the head of the household, who are taking care of family. And it's progressively difficult for them to take care of their families on such a small income. It's bad enough that the minimum wage is only $7.25 here in the state. And then with women making even less, bringing home and making less money, it makes us even at a serious disadvantage, you know. I can remember back in the day when my mother, whom was an educator, she was a teacher and later went on to become a social worker. I can remember when she couldn't even buy a house, okay? Regardless of the fact that she had money, she had good credit or whatever, the only way she could buy a house was on a contract. Well, times have changed from there. They have come a long way, but there's still a lot of work that is left to be done. And I think we are doing a disadvantage, not only to our women, but to our people here in the entire state. Because when we still put more money into the economy, we get a heck of a lot out. You know that. You just mentioned about the income tax windfall that the state has gotten this past year. So those are the things that are very disturbing to me.
Are one of the major issues, would you feel, is concerning women's economic mobility? You mentioned, of course, about the gender pay gap, which needs to be definitely addressed. But as you mentioned, I guess it's part of the issue of being able to let women become more economically mobile. And it's not just putting women above men, so to speak, in the rankings. It's about making sure that everybody is paid well and paid equally.
Absolutely. And the reality is this. You know, you look at it this way. Maybe it's a difference of maybe 50 cents. But over a period of time, that 50 cents amounts to a lot of money. That also means that woman will have to work longer, in some instances, it's 5 or 6 years, in order to get the same retirement money that her male counterpart was doing, mm-hmm. who was making that 50 cents or 75 cents per hour more. So those type things add up. Not only do they add up, you're talking about health care, and all of the things go into the equation, and that puts her at a serious disadvantage. And even if she does have a spouse or a significant other, that puts that family at a disadvantage, because the funds that she was making or should make, that would put that family in a much better position to afford the necessity.
I would imagine these are, of course, long-term impacts that affect working women, but we have the short-term impact, of course, that we're still dealing with, of course, which is the COVID-19 pandemic, and it's made it very difficult for everyone, and particularly for working women.
Absolutely, because now you have got a lot of people who don't want to go back to work, and because they want to stay home and take care of their children, because of the impact, the CARES program, and because of the money that they got from the CARES program. And, you know, it's kind of a hard pill to swallow for families, because they're not understanding that even though this mother or the wife is getting X amount of dollars and she's staying at home, she's not increasing her Social Security or her pension or whatever, so she's going to have to pay later. So that's like a double whammy, if you will.
We're talking with State Representative Carolyn Jackson. She represents Northwest Indiana District 1 for the House of Representatives, and she's one of the panelists for the July 28th virtual event, which is part of the Women for Change series, which is entitled Listen, Connect, Participate. And the latest in the series of forums online will be entitled Economic Stability. What are you going to be able to bring to the event here, and what you know, at least so far in talking maybe a little ahead of time, that your colleagues on the panel will talk about?
Well, what I think I will bring to the table is, I guess, a social work or sociology type aspect, mm-hmm. because it's happening throughout the country. It's just not here in our neck of the woods, so to speak. But other cities have worked through that. They have increased. They have made sure that women would be making the same amount of money that their male counterparts are making, who are doing the same job side by side. Okay, they have put in steps in order to prevent that happening. So therefore, I feel like it makes their economy much stronger. So those are the issues and things that I would be bringing forth tomorrow, because I think we need to look at the whole picture, and I think Indiana is losing out when it comes to affording those women the same opportunity financially that men are getting, I should say.
I know that the Chancellor Allison Bell with WGU Indiana, I'm sure, is going to talk about for those people who are very much involved in looking to better their careers, to be able to be more economically able to take care of their families and like. So we're talking about higher education, and I'm sure she can probably will focus in a lot on what the opportunities that universities like WGU Indiana can bring to women to help make them more economically viable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think women want to be able to be financially stable so that they can be able to contribute not only to their families, but to society. Women want to be able to go out and make the necessary purchases and things that they need to make. They want to have that nest egg, so to speak, so that if something should happen, they don't have to go to family members or whatever to try to get funds to pay for those things, you know. And I think that the program tomorrow, I think a lot of aspects will be brought out. At least I hope so. And I think that those ideas that we get from them, hopefully we can use them downstate here, mm-hmm. to add to or give us ammunition, I put it that way, to try to get those bills heard. Because not only have I filed the bill for equal pay for women, but several other of our legislators have as well. And I'm sure you remember my predecessor, Linda Lawson. She carried that bill for many years and was not able to get it through. So I think that the more people get on board and more that we will continue to work for the common cause of equal pay for women and affording them the lifestyle that they should have, I think that I put it that way, mm-hmm. that out of this show that we'll be able to get that boost or that shot in the arm that we need in order to get that bill heard.
One of the other people that are going to be involved in the online event tomorrow, besides Representative Jackson, is Joy Mason. She's going to be moderator of the panel. She spent a lot of her time working for Eli Lilly and Company out of Indianapolis, and now she is off in another venture herself called Optimist Business Solutions. Have you had a chance to talk with Ms. Mason, certainly about what she's done? And at least she seems like she's a very interesting person to be able to bring up and help moderate this type of program.
No, I have not had an opportunity to talk to her. However, I have heard a lot of her people talk about some of the ideas and things that she has. So I'm definitely looking forward to hearing what she has to say, as well as to connect with her, as well as some of the other legislators. Because with her being right here at Eli Lilly, that's just a short distance away from the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we would be able to sit down and talk and bring her in to discuss what our ideas are, as well as how we can work on our bills to hopefully tweak them in such a way that we can get them heard. Because it's always great to hear from a professional's perspective, but it's also great to hear from those individuals who are suffering and who are going through the chores of having to deal with the inequality of pay.
Women for Change, which is the nonpartisan organization,
sure,
that is organizing this particular event. It's part of the overall series it's putting on here. Works as well in partnership with a number of other groups. The National Coalition of 100 Black Women has an Indianapolis chapter, and I'm sure that you've had an opportunity to talk with many of them at the time they're at the State House when they've come in to lobby and to talk with you about measures that you've sponsored or you've supported. Are these other organizations you think are going to be a good partnership to bring up this topic that's going to be discussed tomorrow?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. You know, advocacy works. Advocacy works. I cannot stress that enough, you know. And this is our state, okay? And in order for it to work for us, we as individuals, as residents, as activists, we have to let our voice be heard. And we are, as legislators, it is our job to listen to those individuals here in the state. I listen to those individuals who are in my district, but I listen to those people who are throughout the entire state, because they have a different perspective, or they have a perspective that maybe you haven't considered. And the thing of it is, when there's hearings and things like that, we listen to what they have to say. And a lot of times, based upon what we have been told, that can change a vote.
Do you think that there'll be other opportunities that I'm sure will come out of this, and maybe some feedback will come back from this discussion on July 28th about the issue of the gender pay gap in Indiana, maybe coming up with an idea for another bill that you may have an opportunity to sponsor or co-sponsor in the next legislative session?
Absolutely. I feel very strongly it will. You know, I have only been, this is my second term, and I have filed that equal pay bill every year, every session. Not only have I filed it every session, but I have met with countless individuals, males, females, organizations, et cetera, and discussed this issue. And it is a very serious issue. And we have so many people who are interested in seeing something happen. However, we just have not been able to get a hearing on it. You see, what determines whether or not you get a hearing is a committee chairperson. And the committee chairperson has not been willing to hear the bill. So I am just hoping that we will be able to find other avenues and get other avenues from the different forums and events that we are participating in, and in hopes that that would give him a different look as to why it's so important in order to hear that bill.
Well, Representative Jackson, thank you for being with us to talk about your participation in the panel. It's coming up on July 28th, another virtual session involving Women for Change, which is an organization here in Indiana that educates, equips, and mobilizes Hoosiers to be making more positive change for women. The event is available now still. You can sign up by going on to the website, women4changeindiana.org. And thank you for being with us to talk about what's going to be discussed tomorrow.
Thank you so much, and you have a great day.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
You're listening to Originally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, even recently, Indiana state lawmakers have been able to determine and pass on through the state government the fact that Hoosier taxpayers will get a little tax break in this next year because more money came into the budget this time around, and that means it's hit this milepost that means it's going to kick in an automatic tax return for some. And that's not unique for an Indiana situation. It's happening around the country. Awash in cash, state lawmakers everywhere seem to be asking how long this boom is going to last, and that is a lot of what's coming up in a series of reports coming out from the Pew Charitable Trusts as part of the project entitled Stateline. With us to talk about some of these topics is Sophie Quinton. She is a staff writer for the Pew Charitable Trust. She writes about fiscal and economic policy for Stateline. And Sophie, welcome to Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be with you today.
I know some good news here for lawmakers, certainly because they worry about where it's going to come up with the funds to pay for various services and the like and to be able to plan for the future. Of course, it means in this case with money coming back, at least for this year ahead, for taxpayers. But it's just interesting how state tax collections, which is under scrutiny these days, has turned out. Will you tell us more about what you folks with the Pew Charitable Trust have learned in the state line report that you're going to be talking about in the weeks ahead?
Sure. So I started reporting on what was going on with state budgets way back when the pandemic began. And the story that is up today kind of recaps the journey that state budget writers have been on since March 2020. So back at the end of legislative sessions last year, governors and legislators were really worried. Businesses were shutting down, people were being laid off, lawmakers were thinking, wow, we're going to go into a severe recession and that is going to have a big impact on tax collections and therefore the state budget and what we're able to afford as a state. So back then, governors, including Governor Holcomb, were directing agencies to cut services. There was a lot of concern. But really, those worst fears that lawmakers had back then haven't been borne out at all. Tax collections remained strong. People were able to keep shopping. People who had higher incomes kept their jobs by and large. And the federal government did an enormous amount of sort of relief activity, both in terms of, you know, business loans, making unemployment benefits more generous. The economy really kept humming along in a way that nobody expected at the end of legislative sessions last year. So, yeah, now we have states, including Indiana, you know, with more money coming in than they anticipated, and several states are in that same position of now saying to residents, actually, you're going to get a tax refund in a year or so because, you know, we have so much money, we've hit that threshold.
What were some of the reasons why it seems that the COVID-19 recession wasn't like past downturns, that for some reason it wasn't quite as bad, especially here in Indiana?
Yeah. It's really interesting. Some lawmakers have said to me that it didn't, you know, from their perspective, it was more like a natural disaster than like a true economic downturn, as we've seen in the past. And I guess there are a couple of dynamics there. One, you know, this enormous amount of aid that's come to states and to folks from the federal government really played a big role in allowing people to keep paying the bills, whether that's, you know, these business loans that kept businesses afloat despite various shutdowns and closures, or these unemployment payments. I mean, there was really just a lot of aid that juiced the economy at this time. And I think that the general dynamics of the recession were just very unique. It was very short-lived. We recently learned that the recession itself lasted only about 2 months, which I don't think anyone would have expected this time last year when so many people were out of work. But the economic activity really continued. And I think one thing that's important when you're thinking about state taxes is that from an income tax perspective, people who earn more money, high income earners, they're more important because they pay more money in taxes just because they have higher income. So the fact that those people kept their jobs, made money on the stock market, I mean, for states that really rely on income taxes like California, I mean, they really just saw an enormous increase in tax collections, which is unusual, but I think speaks to kind of how this past recession was very different from what we've seen in the past, the Great Recession, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sophie, I understand that the way things were written up here and finally where the American Rescue Plan was adopted and put into effect, that there's no real rush for states, I mean governors and legislators, to have to spend the money that they're getting. And so they're able to kind of spread it out over time, aren't they?
Yes, I think so. I think, and again, I haven't totally talked to Treasury on this,
right.
So I'm pretty sure about this, but I'm not totally sure. I think states have until 2025 or 2026, so fiscal 2025, I suppose, to spend this money. So they do have time to be thoughtful, be deliberative. I mean, in a lot of states, the legislative session is already over, and legislators want to have a say in how this money is spent. So from that perspective, it makes sense for them just practically to delay some of these decisions to next year. So it's different in that way to past federal relief packages, because there isn't this sense of, you know, we have to get the money out the door now. There is a chance to be more deliberative here and think carefully about how this money can best set states up for success moving forward.
It also seems, too, that since this money has come in one big lump, all of it at one time, it seems, because of the way that it was set up from Washington, and states get to spread it out maybe within a year or two's worth of budgets, they probably won't have much of an idea until maybe later on whether it's going to have a real impact on the future budgets from that.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's sort of interesting thinking about where state budgets go from here. We do have this federal aid that lawmakers are going to be able to draw from moving forward. But we're also, you know, it's always uncertain what's going to happen in the economy beyond that. You know, are we going to continue to see economic growth the way that we saw, at least in recent months, or are things going to flatten out or change? So I think that's a real question that lawmakers and governors are asking and thinking about. You know, how long can we be sort of experiencing this boom in tax revenue that so many states experienced in the past year?
Now, Stateline is a project of the Pew Charitable Trusts, and they're putting out a series. It's called 2021 Legislative Review, and the first of the series we're hearing about today concerning state budgets and telling us all about it is one of the staff writers with the Pew Charitable Trust, Sophie Quinton. Sophie, thank you very much for telling us about this latest in the series of reports coming out from the Pew Charitable Trust, and looking forward to more of them coming out in the future.
Thanks so much, Chris. Have a good day.
Thank you. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And this next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
When I look back on a lot of things, I'm viewing them through a different lens, you know, and so I'm trying to just absorb everything I can from those vivid memories. And so I appreciate everything, the good and the bad, because I wouldn't be here if I didn't experience those things. Growing up in foster care was very interesting. I had to move a lot to different foster homes. It was my younger brother and I. He's 2 years younger than me. And my mother kind of had struggles with substance abuse. So from that is why we went into foster care. Placements were initially supposed to be temporary, and it's not easy to always get a foster family to take siblings, even though the purpose is to try to keep them together. So a lot of foster families intend on taking one, you know, child. And so when there's two, it can be kind of taxing. Also, my brother is of a different race than I am. And so it was difficult to place us in a family where he was accepted, you know, and then I was accepted. And so it was difficult being that we were biracial because he looked more white. And so when we were with white families, it was difficult for me. And then when we were with black families, it was difficult for him. I remember one foster parent in particular, she didn't like my little brother. She had a huge bias against him looking more white than me. And so it was hard because that was my little brother, but I learned so much from her, and she was supposed to be our mother and protect us, but she treated my brother very badly. And I didn't understand that. I think that was my first incident that really exposed what bias and prejudice and racism was. I didn't realize I wasn't white until I was probably 10 or 11. And my mother's white, and I don't know what my father is. My foster mom actually told me, it was the same foster mom that kind of had, you know, some prejudice against my little brother. She said, you need to understand, Tiffany, you're not white. And it was like something switched in my head. It's like I immediately saw my skin color. I saw the texture of my hair and my facial, you know, features. And I looked at my little brother, and he didn't look any different to me, but I did. I think that was like the first time I saw color. And it's funny that I had that experience with my foster mom telling me, Tiffany, you are a black woman. And society and how other people have perceived me throughout life, they don't know how to understand me, you know. And I've had people pull me aside and say, Tiffany, what are you? Can you, you know, we don't know what you are. I learned at a very young age that people have to know what you are and who you are so they can associate it with the level of respect and understanding to put to the interaction that they have with you. Why can't you just interact with me as a human being?
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Indiana University is honoring Dr. Anthony Fauci for his work in HIV/AIDS prevention, as well as being a leading expert during the COVID-19 pandemic. The director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases will receive the Ryan White Distinguished Leadership Award from the IU School of Public Health in Bloomington on December 6th. The award recognizes those who are, quote, exemplary bearers of the standard of excellence and commitment needed to combat HIV/AIDS, unquote, and was created in 2009 by the school's Rural Center for AIDS STD Prevention. The center in Bloomington was created in 1994 and promotes the prevention of HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases in rural America. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Mr. Pierogi returns to talk about the event, Pierogi Fest 2021 in downtown Whiting, as it's being referred to, the return to abnormality. Hope you'll join us for that.